Hello and welcome to We're All Gonna Die and Other Fun Facts, a semi-regular, occasionally amusing, and rarely funny series of conversations on a random topic. This episode is entitled, I guess we'll call it Better Angels of Our Nature, maybe. That's a great title for something. In fact, it's such a great title, it's on a book. And so our episode tonight is about two books, actually, Better Angels of Our Nature and Everyone's Alone Tonight. Both written by, or at least partially written by one of them, or half written by one of them, a repeat guest, a podcast MVP, a veritable, We're All Gonna Die is the home away from home.
I do this a lot.
Yes. For Mr. Jason Baldinger. Hello, hello, hello.
Hello, Matt. Welcome. Thanks for having me back.
You're welcome. Thanks for doing it. Thanks for being here. We're drinking Stonies from...
It's good.
Yeah, it pairs well with pizza and whatever else.
Wow.
You can tell. Yeah.
It pairs well with Mon Valley River water.
Yes. Well, actually, Stonies is from the glass line tanks of Old Latrobe, Pennsylvania.
Oh, well, that water might be clean.
Yeah.
Ish. Let's go with ish.
Ish. Yeah. All right. And so... You have two books?
I have two books.
There are two
new
books.
Books.
Two new
this
books.
This happened again. I keep trying to find ways not to have them converge at the same time, and it seems to always happen that they converge at the exact same time.
Well, you know, I was explaining something to my multi-genre creative writing class about, mm-hmm. and I was using you as an example. I mentioned you in class about... something you had said to me once, and this is a good transition into poetics and a good transition into how you have two books coming out of front. And how many books is that this year?
Well, it's only two this year somehow.
Says, yes.
There is a possibility there could be a third before the end of the year, though.
Third. And you have more than one in the pipeline, though.
I have two in the pipeline. A lost book now, and one last manuscript. And I will probably, when I get back to Pittsburgh, will start working on another manuscript then.
Wow. Which, so as academic beast mode poet, you said to me once, you said to me and a mutual friend once, if I can tell it as a story, I know it's a poem.
Yeah.
I know it can be a poem.
Yeah.
And...
I hold by that.
You hold by that, and which allows then two books to come out
mm-hmm.
simultaneously or whatever.
I'm not writing nearly as much as it seems. I had a really productive stretch.
You had a really productive stretch, I mean, I think...
And now it's just sort of riding... the coattails of the end of that stretch. Although hitting the road will probably,
help me out.
Yeah, as it usually does, so.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that, because I think, Better Angels of Our Nature, the cover actually is a modified American flag.
Picture that I took in New Kensington, Pennsylvania.
Oh, my.
Shop window.
Oh, wow.
I thought that the sweating American flag, or the sweating glass in the American flag, was very indicative of our time, this current moment in American life,
yeah.
which is very distinct and very disturbing and very different. I think we've had terrifying moments for our democracy, but our democracy has not been maybe as endangered in modern times as it is now, maybe not since the Great Depression. So... Hoover's presidency. Had Hoover been reelected, man, America would have gone somewhere else completely.
Yeah.
And again, if Henry Wallace would have gotten the nod instead of Truman, America would have gone in a much better direction. So.
Yeah. Well, I always think about Lindbergh in 36, too.
As
a place, you know. And this came out of my mouth in a classroom the other day. Was you think if Lindbergh had been elected, we would have been talking about storming the cliffs of Dover, not landing at the beach in Normandy.
When fascism was blooming last.
Yes. Which, so, I mean, this, you know, we got to talk about this moment in history, because we have to talk about with Better Angels of Our Nature.
Mm-hmm.
This poem, this collection does seem distinctly different. Like this, if it's an album, like it feels like an album, and it feels like, oh, the band has gone in a new direction. And it's good, and I think there is a tone and a tenor... and a weight
mm-hmm.
to even the more playful poems.
Yes.
Of there is this real notion of danger and anxiety.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the book is very simply a reaction to the last 2 years and what a Trump presidency has brought to a lot of Americans at this point in time. I think there's not a lot of security going on out there, and there's a lot of bluster to lie your way around it, perhaps, for some of his supporters. But for Christ's sake, yeah, we are in a weird moment after what has already been 40 years of the working class losing. Now we're losing so rapidly. I don't know what's left for us, honestly. The reason for Trump's election, the need for a populist. We just, in typical fashion in this country, we elected the wrong populist.
Yeah.
Thanks, Democratic Party, for not running a populist, running us an establishment candidate.
Yeah.
And now their hand will be forced in this next election that they're not going to be able to run. I think Biden's going to blow this thing and is already blowing it, but that's...
I was talking to somebody earlier today, and you know, it came up about Biden is eventually, you give him enough rope, and he's going to hang himself. Mm-hmm. And I was like, yeah, but is that going to be by January 2020 or October 2020?
I think we'll see the answer in New Hampshire and Iowa very quickly.
I hope so. I hope those people are sensible.
When you actually get dealt something that could be real populism, not this fake-ass populism, then maybe it'll dawn on people, especially Iowa has gotten hit hardest in the tariff wars with China.
Yeah.
Those farmers, those poor fucking farmers.
Yeah, and again, it was not a great time for the American family farm.
No, prior to this. And now prior to this,
and now it has... Yeah, again, the farm bailout is now twice the cost of the auto bailout.
Yeah, that seems fair. And there is no end in sight.
And there's no end in sight, and there's no end for the American taxpayer to... Not that it matters, but there's no end to even try to recoup that money.
Exactly.
It's just subsidizing basic survival.
Yeah. Yeah, so for me, Better Angels really starts, not far after the election, the first poem, and it, relatively speaking, runs kind of chronologically for each... new crisis, because there has been a myriad amount of crises over the last few years. And I don't know how much people actually know about democracy and about how this country was founded.
Yeah.
And that maybe is more disturbing to me in some way, shape, or form. Certainly one of the pivotal poems is me walking around D.C. 2 weeks after the election. You know, and it's 10 parts of just the things that I'm noticing in D.C. and not, these things don't necessarily register. I mean, how do most Americans not know the Gettysburg Address? That should be an easy 45 seconds that are just like, this is essential to your citizenship.
Yeah.
One of many things that are essential to your citizenship, as knowing the Bill of Rights or as, knowing... what a constitutional amendment is and why it comes and why it hasn't happened in 25 years at the same point in time.
And why, as we live, not only is there this sort of crisis of democracy and corruption and destruction of values, there is also this profound inability now for our government to solve the most basic problems of living.
And you have the richest country in the world. We continue to get that bandied, and that is true. We are a very rich country, but none of that money is going to the people in the country. It's all going up.
Yeah.
And it is leaving a government handcuffed when the role of government is primarily to spend, to regulate.
Yeah.
And to make things flow.
Yeah.
This is basic.
Yeah.
This is very basic economics and very basic central government.
Yeah, and it's this question of, like, because the very basic is so busted.
Yeah.
You know.
And if you want fiscal responsibility from your government, then you need to charge corporations and rich people taxes to find that balance.
Yes.
Otherwise, you run at deficit spending, which is what governments are supposed to do anyway. It's something that governments do.
Yeah.
Fiscal responsibility is important, but there are other things that are more important, like stopping recessions before they happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or guaranteeing citizens' basic safety, or healthcare, or whatever. And so for me, it's like these poems... it's another thing that sort of came up in our creative writing class, my creative writing class that I'm teaching, is, you know, we read Donald Murray piece about his experience in the war.
Okay.
And about how all these years he never thought of himself as a vet. And he realized that he had all these profound experiences and this PTSD and this humanized... I mean, he has this amazing piece, part of it, where he's talking about how they say you never hear the artillery shell that almost gets you.
Right.
And he's literally out in the woods somewhere near Normandy. And he's taking a shit in the middle of the night, next standing next to a guy who's squatting and taking a shit too. Mm-hmm. And that guy got blown up. Like, that, the shell missed him and went straight through
this other
the guy standing next to him. And he says, at one point then, I'm suddenly talking to this guy, and next thing you know, I'm covered in a mixture of skin and blood and shit. And it's this guy's, and you know, he's like, and other than feeling suddenly constipated, I got up, ran back to safety, and, you know, filed the report.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I, you know, asked this fundamental question. I was like, you know, we all know that World War II exists. We all know that that had happened. We all know human beings lived through those things. You can look at numbers. But the function of good writing is, how do you humanize that experience so that it is not so hopelessly abstract?
Right.
And that you can taste the horror a little bit. And I think about, for me, the challenge... I mean, for how many people is it, and how many people who claim this pissing ground of reasonable centrist or something, that to even sort of articulate the danger and articulate the crisis and articulate how fundamentally we are in an almost near perfect state of exception. And to articulate that, and to articulate that in poetry, I think is such a challenge.
Yeah.
Because even in our sociological imagination, even in our, you know, political scientists' minds, this is almost hard to wrap our heads around.
I mean, you know, it's another moment in history that we're in. It's hard not to, or it's hard to see beyond the privilege at a certain point in time. You know?
Yeah.
So it's hard to imagine what that war would be like. It's hard to put yourself in the shoes of someone in Yemen at this moment and what they're going through, which is one of the worst humanitarian crises in the world at this point in time. Not to mention what our what U.S. foreign policy has done to Central America, creating the caravans of migrants that we are now trying to turn away at the border, or that we're imprisoning at the border.
Yeah.
You know, you see one side, and this is the media at this point in time. This is the story. These migrants, but not why, not how.
Yeah.
There is no further questioning as to what's going on here. Just these people are storming. Well, why are they coming?
Yeah.
And some of this is also, by and large, preparing for the next phase of humanity and the climate crisis, when mass migrations are going to become essential to survival.
Yeah.
Florida. Yes. When everybody in Florida is a refugee from Florida and now has to move to the rest of the United States, how are we going to handle that? Oh, they're mostly white. It'll be fine. But when everybody in Jakarta can't be in Jakarta anymore, where are they going to go?
Yeah.
And this is the problem in the UK. This is also a problem in the EU. This is not a distinctly an American problem.
No, this is a global moment.
Yes.
That we're having.
And this is where we as humans need to learn to be better than what we are. And we need to stop taking the bait from our overseers in these regards. You know, as they ratchet up the tension between us and... between anybody that doesn't look like us and us.
Which I think is the other thing about Better Angels of Our Nature is it does have this also historical imagination in it.
Mm.
Because again, I, you know what? Hey, suburban white kid of the 80s, I was.
Me too.
The Weekly Reader, right? Remember that? How triumphant America was? Yeah. We had Sally Ride and the Space Shuttle and Michael Jackson and Ronald Reagan. And you get that paper every week and read it and go, ah, you know, this is so cool.
We have things to be proud of.
We have things to be proud of. And I think one of the things that is also, if there is anything, I think, hopeful, one of the hopeful things I feel about this moment in history is that the way queer people, people of color, women have been sort of like, see, we fucking told you.
Yeah.
We've been trying to say this for 40 fucking years, 50 years, my whole life. You know, it's interesting. I have a neighbor who had spent time in South Africa under apartheid.
Mm-hmm.
And she said to me the other day, we bumped into each other at the grocery store. She's like, you know, people keep saying it can't get any worse. And she's like, I lived in South Africa.
No, it can always get worse.
You have no fucking idea how bad it can get. And it's so interesting to me when white people say that because you have no idea.
Yeah, you really don't.
And that's hard to imagine. And I think that's hard to articulate. And I think how many sensible moderates are out there who are just like, oh, I'm just shutting this down. I'm just, well, whatever. Both sides are kind of crazy right now. You know, we're going to have a return to the status quo. And it's like,
no, the status quo didn't work. And that's why we're here.
Yeah.
Because you have a bunch of people who are rightly trying to pull the country in a direction, the left direction, in a direction that celebrates humanity and celebrates difference.
Yeah.
As we all have. And then you have this other that is like, no, I'm white. This is my place. I get to stay here. I am this.
You will not replace us.
Yeah, you will not replace us. And fuck that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fuck that. There is just no way. At some point in time, we're all going to die. That's the name of this show.
That's the name of the podcast.
And
we're all going to die, and everything that we know about this moment in history that we hold dear that makes sense to us will be as sensible and recognizable to people living today reading a novel about 17th century French farmers.
Yeah.
Right? That's you read the Canterbury Tales, you got to work your way into that. You have to think your way into that. There's a lot of content knowledge that you have to build your way in to make sense of that. And that is inevitable for us. All the shit. All of it. Even Facebook is going to become this thing that is so unrecognizable to human beings on the planet.
Yeah.
And that's okay. And it's like, how do we make peace with that as opposed to planting a flag somewhere in the middle of the 20th century and saying that this is what life should be.
But isn't that ultimately the flaw of capitalism? Is, you know, building material possessions to thwart your own death and then not being able to accept your own death, so continuing to stumble over these premises over and over again.
And also it is, I mean, my main guy is Zygmunt Bauman. I'm teaching him to right now. Where he talks about like the way that the promise of modernity has gone insane.
Mm-hmm.
Modernity, the idea of positivism, we can use science and technology to fix all of our problems.
And we can't.
And that we can't. He's got this book that changed my life called Modernity and Ambivalence, where it talks about how then this hope of expunging all the bad shit, you know, sugar free everything.
Yeah.
We can live in a sugar-free world, but everything will be really sweet, is also a form of intolerance, and maybe that naturally always leads to some form of intolerance, but also a complete lack of perspective on the human experience.
Yeah, that seems fair. So we can go backwards and go to the previous Benger Baldinger book.
Yeah, if we could, if we may. Little Fires Hiding. We'll read from the new books, too. Don't worry, folks.
This is maybe a mantra, since this is what we're talking about. We might as well take care of this, right?
Yeah.
It'll bookend us. It doesn't look like August. The green in the cemetery still unsinged by summer heat. The rain keeps coming. It leaves everything lush. It doesn't really get hot here anymore. It doesn't really get cold here anymore. The bank is closed. On Butler Street, I almost get T-boned by someone not paying attention to traffic. The refineries look like heaven. The 62nd Street Bridge, Sharps Hill lose themselves. Time is the equivalent of nothing. Time is nostalgia dying. Last night, we ushered out a wake for a favorite bar. We talked about how many shows and how many dollar-skunked beers we drank. We are the age of things that aren't there anymore. We question our anchors and our moorings. I woke up this morning to news of hate rallies, and I'm disconcerted. You will not replace us. You will not replace us? There is no permanence to this world. We only have a modicum of control over the lives we lead. I'm sure that's hard for some people to admit. To exert force to retain some fleeting control is madness, an unhealthy sense that we mean more in the eye of the universe. Everything we see here will someday be gone. Everything we know will someday be gone. Everything, everyone, gone. And I find comfort in that personally. I cross the Allegheny again, follow the S-curves up Negley. I've accomplished nothing this morning. I have White Antelope's words in my head, maybe a mantra. Nothing lives long, only the earth and the mountains. I think that covers it.
Yeah, no, that's some that's some Eric Fromm shit in there. Biophilia, he would call it. Biophilia, the love.
I do love Eric Fromm.
Yeah, you know, the love of change, the love of life, which is naturally
the fact that there is chaos and change. Just got to run with it sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, with the line from George, what, Santanaya's Cloud Castles.
Okay.
Where he starts by saying, you know, it would be bad philosophy to condemn birds for their ability to fly or fish for their proclivity for living underwater.
Mm-hmm.
But quite a number of philosophies condemn life for changing, which, much like birds flying and fish living underwater, it's is exactly what it is, yes. Yeah. And he has this amazing dreamlike essay about how do we make peace with eternal change. And
put your head down and accept it at a certain point in time.
Yeah, and I think some it's things changing are gonna work the value somewhere. System, yeah.
Yeah.
Which I think the other thing is change, and the other thing I wanted to get to is you talking about travel and how travel will inevitably produce work.
Yes.
And can we talk about that, the role of travel in your poetics, and why and how for you travel as an inspirational and its role in your poetics?
I mean, certainly, growing up in a pre-9/11 world, as you and I did.
Yeah.
Which,
by the way, fall of 2019 freshmen were born.
Yes.
In 2001.
Yeah, Jesus Christ, that blows my mind.
Yeah.
There was, and part of this was probably being male and white.
Yeah.
There was a right to the road that we grew up with.
Yeah.
I know that you like to wander as well.
Yes. Yeah.
Not quite maybe to the level that I do.
No, not quite. No, I get to the Laurel Highlands and I turn around, basically, is what I do. Or I get to Youngstown and I turn around.
But there was still that gasp, that breath, that you had to know America and you got to know America from the road. Kerouac preaches that, certainly.
Yeah.
But there are so many other writers, whether it be William Lee's Heat Moon, who was a huge influence on me, on down the line. Travel novels are so prototypically and essentially American in the same respect.
Yeah.
Which also kind of boggles my mind how we ended up in this backwards place. You know, the concept of continuing to move and move forward, and now we're in this, like, nope, I'm stuck right here.
Yeah.
So, ultimately, you grow up with that as your birthright to some extent. The need to move about the country. And for me, driving will ultimately soothe me. No matter how crazy being on the road can be, yes. You have those moments that, you know, like people are driving like assholes or whatnot, but that's a minor inconvenience. It's the hum of the road and the wheels, the wind, you know, music, whatever, it soothes my brain and it allows me to calm down and to see the world more slowly than I would, much as if I were high, which sometimes I am.
Yes.
And then to be able to see how things fit or how things look in a more open or honest state, hopefully, perhaps.
Yeah.
I hope I'm not being pretentious in any way by saying that. Yeah, I think that becomes or became so important for me, and I just don't know a way around that. Constant movement is essential to my being as a human at this point in time in my 40s. So constant movement in all of these poems is also necessary to the storytelling. It would be a disservice to me as a human to try and write poems that stand still.
Yeah, which I, you know, I think about that, right? And my love for movement, and I'm in the point where I have a dying car.
Mm-hmm.
I have a car that needs to be replaced.
Yeah.
And I got the call yesterday
yes.
from the mechanic who was just like, "I not only can I not fix this at my facility here, but you shouldn't. It's time to trade her in." And I was completely bummed out because I became emotionally attached to that thing. Mm-hmm. And Danelle had class, and so she took her car somewhere else. And there I was, really bummed out and going, "Man, I want to go for a drive right now."
I mean, that's me.
And you know, like, just going, "Oh, I can't do that because eventually this thing will not move anymore." And there's also this thing for thinking of a sense of, for me, it almost freaks me out to think I was born at a different moment in history.
Yeah.
And that we wouldn't have that. You know, when the Pennsylvania Railroad came in, Pittsburgh to Philadelphia went from 40 days to 8 hours.
Right.
And to live in a slow era where your sense of space and movement could be so limited to
a neighborhood.
A neighborhood.
Or a city.
Or two cities. Or two cities,
yeah.
Maybe. One of my Facebook memories was this old lady in Greenfield that we would just talk to sometimes when she would be out walking our dog, and mm-hmm. we'd walk our dog and we'd encounter her and talk, and I think she was in her 90s and she had never made it to Cleveland. And we said something, "Oh, we were in Cleveland. I haven't seen you in a week." And I said, "Oh, we were in Cleveland for the film festival or mm-hmm. something. Are we in Cleveland for something?" She's like, "Oh, I've never been. What's it like?" and I just said flat, and that blew her mind. I had a neighbor in Greenfield that had never been to Homestead. And for people who are not from Pittsburgh, people from Pittsburgh don't know where the fuck Greenfield is, but there is a bridge basically linking part of Greenfield
to Homestead.
There is a bridge that you can cross that will put you in Homestead. And she was in her 50s, half a century on the earth, mm-hmm. and had not crossed the Mon River and been to Homestead. And that shattered my mind like mm-hmm. that. Wow.
Yeah. I remember getting into an argument with a gentleman in a bar here in Pittsburgh who said I couldn't claim to be a Pittsburgher because I left my home neighborhood. That he grew up in South Oakland and he had never left South Oakland, and fuck me for leaving North Side.
Wow.
Brighton Heights. You know?
Wow.
Yeah. Those mentalities are deeply ingrained, and, you know, I understand the need to not want to leave your comfort.
Yeah.
But at the same point in time, nothing happens in your life if you don't leave your comfort.
Yeah.
You know?
Which I think is absolutely, I mean, it's part of this travel thing is this way that it is a disruption.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that it makes you notice. Even going into Eastern Ohio for me is like, oh, wow, the world is different.
Mm-hmm.
And the world is worse.
Yes. You know? In Ohio? Yes. Yeah. Certainly. Sorry, Ohio. I'll be there next week. But,
but you know, I always like, and I mean, there's also this thing of like, for me, driving is also freebasing a landscape
mm-hmm.
through a car windshield.
Well, it's learning to read.
Yeah, it's compressing an entire landscape
mm-hmm.
through that windshield and feeling that and experiencing that space in mm-hmm. such an intense, concentrated way.
Yes. And if you've ever crossed 7 states in one day, that gets even more intense in that regard, to the point where you don't remember what you've done to some extent. Yeah. But it's at this time in history, I can think of nothing more important than kind of meandering and seeing what's happening everywhere. Yeah. I honestly would love that Ernie Pyle or John Gunter moment in history, as there was in the 30s, where there was just an everyman kind of reporter who was just going and talking to people, running to somebody in a diner, yeah. and you write a 500 word story about them, what you talked about.
And this is what America is.
Yeah, Humans of New York sort of does that.
Yeah.
But that's New York, and New York is a monstrosity, a beautiful monstrosity, but it's completely its own beast, too.
Yeah.
It's not the rest of America.
Yeah.
It is something, there's something incredibly American about New York, but
yes.
the rest of America and New York are completely different.
Yeah, it's the pine tar version.
Yes.
Yes, it's the black tar version of yes. America, that you scrape and ingest in whatever ways. But, I mean, what a wonderful part of America. But
yeah,
it is a different monster.
Yeah, it's so diverse and so much.
Yeah.
In some ways, it can be the best of what we are, and in some ways, it's absolutely the worst of what we are.
Yeah, and it's funny because, too, even I have friends who come here, will visit here from New York, and they'll be like, one of them made the joke to the other one the one time, because, literally, they parked the minivan in front of my house, and the guy walked in and didn't think to shut the door. And he's like, what, are you one of those New Yorkers that can't function outside of New York City? And he was like, oh, shit, I think I am. This is good. And they were like, oh man, this is going to be a long week. They're on their way to Kansas City, so.
Well, let's do a poem that mentions Kerouac in New York City here.
There we go. And,
this is from Better Angels. This is the end poem. Poem called Kerouac Go Home. I hear the waitress's footfalls, and they sound like roses as they echo across Avenue B. As they echo across the Avenue of the Americas, as they echo at the intersection of Bleecker and McDougal, where Silsby can't understand why there are so many fucking people. Sure, he's got a few drinks in him, but I never thought I'd see New Yorkers turn heads at open indictments of procreation, or at least procreation with the intent to further the fading bulb of humanity. Jay and Allie say they used to write Kerouac Go Home on the men's room wall at the White Horse. Dylan Thomas is bleeding out. The blood trail runs to the Chelsea Hotel, then beyond. I slipped on it when I tried to remember the last time I had a future. I tried to remember the last time I saw the ocean. There were Mustangs racing on the Garden State Parkway. There were little hands waving on the BQE. And I swear there was a Liberty torch in the harbor, its head struggling above the surface. I've snagged myself a driftwood sculpture. There's so much debris. The gulls have picked through the soft-shelled and horseshoe crabs. The few untouched are boiling to burst. But the ocean, it still waves under the twin eyes of lighthouses. It never bothered with magic or loss. Find that I have a very difficult relationship with Kerouac at this point in time in my life.
Yeah.
You know. How
would you not?
You should. Very much so.
Yeah. I mean, it's 20th century.
Yeah.
He's middle of the 20th century. There's a sensibility there. There's a puppy outside that just yelped.
Yes.
I'm sure the mic caught that.
Oh, no, she's whining. We're going to catch puppy whines now for a while.
Wow. Poor Libby. Anyway, yeah, I think Kerouac, and especially, I mean, you think he's one of those, the turn he made at the end of his life.
Oh, God.
It's like, now do you, how do you read those, how do you see those signs?
Yeah, I mean,
it's
so hard to read Desolation Angels.
Which is the last one I've read.
You don't need to read Vanity of Dulos, or I think there's one other one at that point in time, too. And to watch, maybe in some ways, the chickens come home to roost for him you know, for being such a shitty human. Yeah. You know, the overdose in Tangiers just shatters him as a man. Yeah. In that regard. And in some regards, you deserved it.
Yeah.
And in other regards, no one deserves that. Yeah. It depends on which side of that you want to stand on at this moment. I see both arguments very easily. But those books, On the Road and Dharma Bones, and particularly when I was 18, 19 years old, along with, you know, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
Me too.
You know, you read those as a rite of passage.
Yeah.
Almost. They're the first things that you find that are literature that are outside of generally what you've been assigned.
Perhaps. Yeah. Yeah. And I think, again, I mean, there's a sense of freedom. There is a sense of intimacy with mm-hmm. those books that I know at that stage I desperately craved
mm-hmm.
from anything and everything, you know.
Well, I mean, again, another side of that time period, pre-internet, sort of, anyway.
Yeah.
Was that you could see that the world was bigger than what you thought it was. Bigger than the small town in New Jersey that you grew up in, or the small town in PA that I grew up in.
Yeah.
And there was every bit the need to get to that.
Yes. And other. to know your little town was fucked,
mm-hmm.
but then not to know what to do about it, you know?
Well, that ineffectual nature maybe is part of the thing that's crippled our generation and why we're in this morass that we're in.
Yeah, no, I mean... But you're right. I mean, those books really filled in. I mean, the Viking portable beat reader. Holy mm-hmm. shit.
Yep.
I mean, I could not be the person I am with the fact that if the Walden books in the shitty mall near my house didn't have the Viking portable beat reader,
mm-hmm.
which I read that cover to cover the weekend I bought it. Or, well, I talked my mom into buying it for me. Let's be honest. No posing. Talk my mom into buying that. Oh, what's that? Oh, it's about American literature. Oh, okay. and you know, I read that whole thing and in, you know, cover to cover, pretty much nonstop. I put everything aside. There was something for our generation, I think, in our pre-internet. I mean, at least the internet, you can find virtual communities... Though there's something lacking in those, but at least you can hear voices that a white kid in the suburbs in the era of monoculture could never have heard.
Right.
Except for Kerouac, Ginsberg, Burroughs, you know, in the Viking Portable Beat Reader. But also, I think for me, is that part of the romance for the road, is that you know your situation is fucked, and where do you go?
Well, maybe...
What are the alternatives? What are the meaningful alternatives?
Maybe that's the grass is always greener side of it. If I keep moving, I will never see a place that, you know, everything is going to always be getting better because I'm never standing still long enough or something, I guess.
Yeah.
Would be the way to look at that.
But your poems, though, like the places you find, and I think, I mean, one of my favorites, though, maybe this isn't necessarily a travel poem, but Poem for the Waitress at Red Robin on page 32. Like, you find this America that is busted.
Well, I think that was...
In other ways. You know, in ways that are maybe more dire than we experience here in Pittsburgh. Because Pittsburgh is... at least in some ways, a functional part of this country.
Yes.
In ways that, you go to Eastern Ohio, East Liverpool.
East Liverpool, Youngstown. Chillicothe.
Chillicothe, yeah.
You know, any of those towns. And I think maybe that's the other side of the road poems for me, is, you know, you have this majestic concept of what... the American landscape, you know, in some ways, the death knells of manifest destiny come through that, too. There's always a West.
Yes.
And, yes, fuck that at this point in time. Fuck that then. But as you get out there, and I, you know, I did my first road trip in 97, and then I was too broke to be on the road again until 2003.
Wow.
So you have a whole different America than the one that you expected. You know, that majesty is not there.
Yeah.
You know, yes, you can catch a beautiful sunset over an ocean or on some mountain, but if you're in small town America, which is honestly where I feel most comfortable.
Yeah.
Pittsburgh being a very large small town.
Yeah.
I don't do well in larger cities.
No.
I don't know if you feel the same way. I certainly, you know, you see how broken it is.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Kerouac was too busy with his beatific,
visions
to report on what he was seeing. And none of those writers talked about the boredom that comes with the road. Because there is, you know, there is a whole other side of that story that was left out. And has been left out of the conversation for 200 fucking years. And now, this is where Ernie Pyle and John Gunter come in. Because they at least talked to everyman. This is where Studs Terkel came in.
Yes.
These people were so important for that. Because they identified the other side of America. So as you're wandering, as you're traveling, as you end up in a conversation with somebody in a Montana bar, you're going to end up hearing stories that don't jive with what the myth and the legend of the American dream, which has been pronounced dead as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
And so that's the other side of these poems. Yeah. So let's read the poem for The Waitress at Red Robin then.
Yeah.
Because I don't know where else to go with to that sentence either. So. Poem for the Waitress at Red Robin. This evening, it's painfully clear that we are a nation of middle managers. Purposeless and ineffectual, seated in cubicle booths, staring at cubicle buildings, doctor's office architecture retail, doctor's office architecture townhomes. Decorated with blandly evocative Americana spilled loudly across walls. It's my niece's birthday, and I'm not about to reason with a 5-year-old why this place is awful. Rachel is our waitress. Her name in black marker droops in the same sad, tired way she carries herself. And I don't know how many tables she has. The wait staff is jumping, feigning boisterous friendliness, except Rachel, who probably goes home to kids and has to try not to be too tired to take care of them. The food is worse than I remember, and the TV over our head blares, and the TV on the table tries to sell us games. The noise and the room throbs, dull crescendos, you can't hear the person next to you. Maybe we don't want to hear the person next to us. My nephew has taken a toothpick from his burger, says it's a sword, now it's a gun, he's fighting imaginary bad guys. I take the toothpick and I break it in 3 pieces. I say, can we pretend there are no weapons and there are no bad guys? Here's the state of Oklahoma. This is the state of Delaware, and this is the Washington Monument. Imagine a story where you're there and there are no bad guys. Instead, it's a pistol, a sword, and something else. This narrative is fed to us so young. Maybe that's why so many Americans fight bad guys that never existed. 2 ice cream sundaes have arrived, and Rachel is back with 3 other waitresses. They sing happy birthday to my niece because they have to. Because it isn't life. It isn't work. Unless you demean yourself for tips. You know, you find that just everywhere. People trying so hard to... We're okay, and they're just... falling apart while they're trying to be okay.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, good poem.
Thank you.
No, but yeah, you're right. I mean, there's all that struggle.
Mm-hmm.
There's all that. And again, I for me, it's like how... These Better Angels of Our Nature years have really stripped all of that away from me.
Mm-hmm.
And as much as I realize it was stupid and naive and shitty white male privilege to believe in that. Man, I just miss it for like 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't it be great for 5 minutes to just not feel like the apocalypse has begun? Wouldn't that be cool?
It just... would, but I mean, when the apocalypse is already here and you have 30 years left, theoretically, of humanity, probably no more, unfortunately, than that.
Yeah.
We don't have that luxury anymore. And there's so much of just needing to listen, fix, and change as quickly as we can to be open to the dialogues that are going on around us.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, if 2016 didn't prove that, I don't know what does. I mean, we should have been there way before in a lot of respects.
Yeah.
But that sort of slow change, things not getting worse, which has been most of our lives, which just meant things weren't getting worse for us.
Yeah.
As white men.
Yeah. Or things weren't just abjectly shitty to begin with.
Yes.
For us.
Yeah. That's... I mean, that's a very difficult lesson. And there seems to be a lot of people that just won't even accept even a tip of that lesson at this point in time. So, yeah. I don't know. Why don't we do one more poem here?
Yes, let's. From Better Angel. From Everyone's Alone Tonight.
We'll move to Everyone's Alone, yeah. We'll do, since it fits in the same category with the Red Robin poem, this is the most Pittsburgh poem I've ever written, I think. It's called The Ballad of Dominic Irace. And for those of you following along at home, you know who Dominic Irace is if you're from Pittsburgh, and if you don't, well, the poem will help you out a little bit.
Yes.
When my mother's second marriage dissolved, she spoke mostly in dreams. We were grown, still she wanted to take us to Disneyland. She wanted to buy us a house. She wanted to keep us safe after 6 years of mostly volatile, rarely easy peace. She was 40-something, working two jobs, circling the drain. And I was barely 20, working two jobs, circling the drain. Neither one of us could afford a house alone. She asked me to co-sign. After the Jaggers broke a massive hit with the rapper, Dominic Irace changed his name, had a few big hits regionally with a band called the Cruisers. If you live in Pittsburgh, you hear Aaliyah or Love is Like a Rock as regular as Stairway to Heaven. In the mid-90s, Irace wrote Mortgages. Rockstar life confined to weekend warrior status. And I recognized him, but I didn't care. I was never starstruck, not by rock stars, not by mortgage brokers. He's professional and goofy till my mom steps out. At the copy machine, his posture changes. He's relating to me now, like he wants to be remembered as King Cool. Copier light glows green, and he shakes his head and says, "It's a bitch, man."
I was astonished when I heard. I had no idea Donnie Irace
was a mortgage broker.
Was a mortgage broker.
Yeah, yeah. In Elwood City, Pennsylvania.
What?
Yeah.
In El... Wow.
It was either Elwood City or Beaver Falls, somewhere in one of those
somewhere
towns.
In those counties. Yeah, yeah. Beaver County. Yeah. Wow. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it was like one of those immediate things. It's actually funny because, you know, we were talking about, you know, the need to tell a story. And, you know, I maybe have told this story a handful of times over the years. I was working with my buddy Steve Pellegrino, doing drywall work with him. And we were driving somewhere, and I started in on that story, and his jaw was on the floor by the time I was done. And he's like, "Why is that not a poem?" And I'm like, "Oh, I don't know. I just hadn't gotten there, I guess." And he's like, "Well, I think you need to write that." You know?
Yeah.
And I was like, "Okay, Steve, I got it. It's done." You know, so I think I might have worked with him a day or two later, and I was like, "Oh, by the way, I finished that." You know, I miss working with Steve. Steve was good for either drawing stories out of you or telling you stories.
Yeah.
There are stories scattered throughout some of these books. There is. And that's also an important thing. Oral tradition for poor people
Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't exist. Sorry.
No. Yeah.
Studs Terkel isn't here anymore. And well, somebody needs
to blog.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Somebody needs to be here listening and making sure that other poor people know they're not alone.
Yeah, not that Barbara Ehrenreich tourist shit either.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
We're not talking about, you know, yeah, trust fund visitors to poor land, Poorville. We're talking about real poverty and what it's like.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think certainly if we're transitioning this conversation to everyone's alone tonight, that's something that James and I might have done pretty well. Both of us growing up poor. In various parts of the country. And with the last book, Little Fires Hiding, the collection seemed more like letters back and forth between the cities, whereas this seems like, no, this is what the Midwest looks like. This is what the Midwest feels like now.
Yeah, and it's more letters. It's more, I think, for me, a call and response. Yes. I mean, the thematic links between some of the poems I found just almost uncanny.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so how does the process of getting a book like that together? Did you guys just kind of, this is what I got, or were you sending things constantly back and forth to one another?
It was a this is what I got. I approached him a couple years ago. I met James. And I don't know if we're backtracking or covering things that we covered in a previous podcast.
Unfortunately, because of the phone thing, the last one sounded really weird.
Oh, okay, so, that's true.
And so.
So I met James in 2016 in Blue Springs, Missouri at a reading, in which I met a number of other very good friends of mine in the Kansas and Missouri area. And I've been an admirer of James's work. I mean, immediately, as soon as he read poems, I was like, I know this dude, you know.
Yeah.
We went to different schools together, you know, in that regard.
Yes.
And so I hit him up when the last one came out in 2018. So 2017, around the end of 2017, I was like, hey, would you like to do a split book together? And he was like, yeah, I think that's a really good idea. How do you want to approach it? I was like, well, why don't I just send you a bunch of poems? And originally, I was going to send it in March of 2018, but I had a chapbook that was turned down. So I had 20 poems that I had already kind of constructed as a book. I pulled a couple things out, added a couple things different, sent them to him, and he went through what he had, and he paired things up. So we just did this, the reverse this time. He sent me 20 poems, and then I read them, and I went through what I had to see what fit.
Oh, wow.
So it's a different sort of collaboration. It's not like, you know, we went line by line, or he was sending me a poem, and like, can you answer this?
Oh, wow, okay. Because I had wondered about that, because of the pairings are so on point, that there were, like, oh, these things were written for this.
No, there's that defined fact that he gave me the 20 poems from Everyone's Alone, and it was actually under the title of, I believe, what the first poem was at that point in time, which is In This Town was supposed to be the original title. And I, as I read it, there's the, I can't remember, I'm sorry, which poem he talks about everyone being alone tonight. I think maybe that is the title of the poem. I've read this book so many times now, I can't remember.
Yes, page 31.
Page 31. I'll read James's poem then.
Yes.
In a moment. So I read it and I immediately sent him a message back and I'm like, these 20 poems are great. I'm happy to work with them, but you buried the lead. The title of this poem, or the title of this book, is Everyone's Alone Tonight. And he's like, wow, I didn't think about that, but yes. So we immediately had that, and then I just sat there and went through what I had. And the last couple of years have, again, been very prolific. So there's a lot of work laying around. And it was like, do I have a poem that can directly tie to this? And just giving it as much thought and consideration as possible, because I wanted to respect the work. And I think, honestly, and I hate to be the dick that says this, I really think this is the best book that has come out with my name on it. I feel that way. So I'm going to read one of James's poems. This is called Everyone's Alone Tonight, the title track, if you will.
Yes, do it.
There's too many people alone here tonight. Almost no conversation unless you count waitresses and bartenders angling for high test tips. The girl by the door, she keeps making the move, like she'll leave as soon as the last one is drained. The next one comes before she can. Stuck in an endless loop, just one more. The old man at the bar is more than hunched over, his infinitely refilling shot and beer, the way his head droops, the liquid will outlast him. The wiry man in the back booth slowly nods his chin down to his chest, bouncing back up, barely touched pitcher vibrating on the scarred table. He shuffles to the can, comes back a few minutes later, a new man, runny nose, red eyes, and a can-do attitude. Everyone in this place is alone tonight. Even the old man in the back room, half-chewed cigar like some cartoon trope, sorting the cash, the checks, the crippling credit card receipts. Everyone's alone tonight. And this place won't fix it.
James Bender, man.
Looking forward to seeing James next week.
Yes.
Next weekend, I guess.
Yeah, so you're on tour then after this.
I have a...
Speaking of travel, you're on tour.
Yes, I have a book release here next Wednesday night at White Whale Books at 7 p.m. April Flynn, Miss Macross, who is also Sheena Carroll, depending on which name she's going by that night. St. Louis Post Dan Wright is flying in, and we'll be reading at White Whale at 7 p.m. and welcoming these two books into the world. And then the next day I take off with Dan, and we read in Nashville on Friday at a place called The Porch. Next Saturday we're at, which is the 4th or 5th of October. I'm in St. Louis. Then I'm in Bell, Missouri on the 6th. And James Benger and I will be reading there along with John Dorsey and a number of other really impressive poets, Victor Clevenger among them. And then I have a day off, and then I'm in Kansas City with James and Sean Pavey to do a unofficial Kansas City book launch for Everyone's Alone Tonight. My publisher is in Kansas City as well. And then I'm in Emporia, Kansas for a house show, and then I have a couple days before I'm in Dallas for another house show.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I'm going to be going. I think I go 4,000 miles to and from.
Wow.
Spent a couple days in New Mexico, and I'm going to hit some civil rights sites coming up through Arkansas and, Tennessee on my way back to Pittsburgh. Because another really important thing about this time is acknowledging what we failed.
Yeah.
And trying to get an understanding of what happened. White men happened, but...
Yes, white people happened.
White people continue to happen.
Yes.
That's the simple answer. But the wave crested in 1968... and rolled back and has been rolling back since then.
Yeah. So where can people get these books? What's the best way for folks to...
Kung Fu Treachery, which is the imprint that published these books, does not have a website that does marketing, but they do sell through barnesandnoble.com.
Okay.
I don't believe they are available on Amazon. Haha. You can get them locally at the White Whale Bookstore. I have not consigned Everyone's Alone Tonight anywhere other than Caliban at this moment, but Better Angels is available at White Whale, Caliban, City of Asylum. Yeah, that's probably about right for right now. Cool. And of course, you can find me on Facebook and, you know, ask me for books, and we can work things out through PayPal as well. Certainly a method that is effective, and the money goes directly to me, and I will probably send you one of those blackout postcard poems that I gave you.
Yes.
Which is...
Chipmunk Hunt.
Yeah, Chipmunk, yeah. Chipmunk. So it's a new little game that I'm playing. So I have more merchandise. I like to send postcards when I'm on the road anyway. Yeah. So if you give me your address, I will send you a postcard while I'm on the road. I can't tell you whether it'll be a poem or whether it'll be some crazy thing or whether I'm going to make up something based on what I see on the postcard. It could be any of those things.
Sounds delightful.
But in the process of that, I hate now shopping for postcards. So I bought a lot of them online, of like 800 for $70. And you get some blanks and you get some filled out. So I was thinking about this like 200 filled out postcards I have. And I was like, what can I do? And I was like, you know what? I'll make up haikus by doing blackout poems out of them. And I can read you a few of them. I just have to find them. But yeah, I'll be giving those away with purchase or selling them for a dollar. Here's some. Got like over 60 of them, but... there we go. So there are such gems as, so far, no rain. So far, or did not get to see, did not get to see, did not get to see, Lord willing, or mammoth now, returning now, 3 days rain, 3 days through snow, and saw three jackrabbits with long ears, never saw one before. Just a little fun game, perhaps.
Speaking of fun little games.
Yes.
So.
Are we,
It's about time for the bottom five.
All right. You want me to read one more poem?
One more poem and we'll do the bottom five. Let's do that.
You wanted me to read you Northside 1982, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Loves me that poem. From.
This is from Everyone's Alone Tonight.
Yes.
This is for the Chicago poet Richard Kronborg. Called Northside 1982. It was every bar in the North Side. Long gone places like the 222 on Federal, the Rosa Villa on East General Robinson, a couple of places lost in Spring Garden, the bar that burned down on Woods Run, that one that seemed darker than the rest somewhere in the holler on Bascom. Riggs on Brighton somehow still stands. Everyone knew my dad, and these places that hung heavy with hunky smoke, these places of little hiding, these places of forgetting, these places with the rough camaraderie of men. And they were always happy to see my dad. He had a baggie or a couple of pills to palm into some cash. We'd belly up the bar, and he'd order a Stroh's. All the bartenders would laugh as I climbed the stool. Already seasoned, I'd order a Shirley Temple or a Roy Rogers. They may muss my hair and say, you got a fine boy. These are the secrets, as they are, as they were, passed down from generations, sometimes from fathers to daughters, always from fathers to sons.
Second most Pittsburgh poem ever.
It's a pretty Pittsburgh poem. Yeah, Kronborg wrote a poem called, I think, Buick 1954. Or 1954 Buick. I can't remember the exact title right now. I think it was him sitting on his father's lap, driving through Chicago as a boy. Mm. And it just, that happened almost immediately after reading that poem. It was like, I just need to digest this for 1 second, and then blah, 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 here comes this poem.
Riggs.
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 Still exists.
Still exists.
Still smoky as fuck.
You can still duck be in Pittsburgh. Bowl. Yeah.
Hasn't changed since LBJ was president.
I'm still high up to the Donnie Iris thing. I'm still flat. This flashback of being in my, just moving here, being in my 1988 Buick Century, stuck in traffic on the Boulevard of the Allies in South Oakland on a Friday. Looking at the abandoned Peugeot dealership that is now Luxury Lofts, the corner of Craft and the Boulevard, and DVE playing Olila. Mm. Olia. and just saying, oh, it's Friday, it's time to get wild or whatever, and then busting into that song and going, and the sky was super gray, and I'm like, I'm in Pittsburgh.
You're in Pittsburgh, and it's raining.
And it's raining. And on that happy note, go to Riggs. And now it's time for the bottom five.
All right, give me five.
And five, a series of questions related to our main topic there of a surrealistic and or philosophical nature. And because Mr. Baldinger has been on this so many times.
I broke it.
You broke it. Actually, a couple other people broke it. And I don't want to go through. I have these forms. It's a little insider baseball for you folks. I have these forms for every podcast of guests and what I want to talk about. And just sort of notes. But also has track. And in theory, it was supposed to be, well, you know, what bottom five questions have I asked? And not. And the last few times I've had repeat guests on, I've repeated bottom five questions. So I spent some time today brainstorming a whole new, or almost a whole new page of bottom five questions. So Jason Baldinger, seven-time, eight-time, 20-time guest, till we're all going to die.
Yes.
You are the first person to have a crack at these new, brand spanking new bottom five questions. Are you ready?
I'm ready. Let's do it.
Question one, and actually the poem can't count, but question one, have you had any weird encounters with celebrities that aren't Donny Iris?
I wouldn't say weird necessarily. I've had a lot of encounters with musicians along the way. Fred Schneider, Bobby Gillespie from Primal Scream.
Oh, wow.
Bob Pollard. Bob Pollard was incredibly gracious. I think probably Fred Schneider was probably the most funny of them. Because he came in with his sons into the record store I was working in, wearing a straw boater and just in shorts, like going through CDs. And, you know, Fred Schneider's a very distinct human being.
Yes.
Like, there's one of those things that if you watched MTV, you know, when the B-52s were huge, you know, you knew who he was. And so he came up to the counter and, you know, I don't like being gaudy.
Yeah.
You know, I know that people hate, I always hated doing radio when people recognized my voice and like freaked out. You know, instead of being like, oh, hey, I like your radio show. Thank you. I recognized your voice. You know, and instead going, you're fucking famous. And I'm not fucking famous, okay? I'm just a dude. I'm just another chubby white dude. There's plenty of us out there. There's way too many out there, actually.
Yeah. We need a calling.
Yeah, we may need a calling in that regard. So, you know, Fred comes up to the counter and I'm, you know, hey man, you're Fred Schneider. And he, you know, like you initially kind of like chafed a little bit and kind of a hard side. And I was like, oh, it's all right. You know, I just want to tell you, you know, I know your music. I like your music and I appreciate what you've done. And, you know, we talked for a couple minutes and they were playing at the Palace Theater in Greensburg. So he was immediately like grumping about having to go out 30 through Christian wasteland and abortion billboards to, you know, Route 30. But we had a really nice, very quick conversation, and, you know, and he went on his merry way, but I had a really enjoyable time. Bobby Gillespie was a lot more fun because it was like he was in the store, and I was playing the Rosillos, and he was fucking rocking out, you know, in the store, like pumping fists while like flipping records. And I'm looking at him, and I'm like, I know you from somewhere. What band are you in? And I had to actually get on the internet to figure out that Primal Scream was in town and then that was Bobby Gillespie, you know. So I did cheat a little bit on that one because when he came up to the counter, I'm like, dude, you're Bobby Gillespie. And he's like, yeah, man. Wow, that's really cool that you knew that. And I was like, oh, yeah, it was really cool, man. So he was really excited about me playing the Rosillos and
you did homework.
Yeah, there was that unfortunate moment where he offered me free tickets to the show, and I think I had an out-of-towner poet in that night that I was hosting, and I couldn't go. So like, he offered me the tickets, and that was the only real awkward moment because I was like, "Oh man, I so would come to the show, but I got this other thing I gotta do," and you could just see him sink. You know, when I said that to him, and I was like, it was still a pleasure, though, to meet you and get a chance to talk with you. So yeah, there's a couple answers for you.
All right, question two. Tell me about a sublime performance you witnessed that had a very small audience.
Hmm.
I don't know if this is the ultimate hipster question or not, but...
Well, you know, there's always those weird moments where it's like, do you use a show that you played that you felt weird, you know, mm-hmm. you know, like you felt that connection, and then the audience came up to you afterwards, you know, which is sometimes easier. I'm trying to think. I seeing that I've just told this story recently, we'll go with this. It's not maybe the best answer in the world, but Morphine played at Metropole. I don't know if you remember Metropole.
Yeah, I've been to Metropole a couple times.
Now, it's no longer even a venue. I think they're tearing it down, actually.
Yeah, I think it's going to no longer even be a building soon, yeah.
Yeah. But Morphine played at Metropole within a year of each other twice. So, right maybe as Yes was coming out or right before Yes came out, they played, and there was 200, maybe 300 people in the building, and it was just a perfect show. You know, like one of those things that at 19 or 20 years old, it's exactly what you wanted to have happen. It was like intimate and beautiful. And then they played a year later and Yes had blown up. And there's 900 fucking people in the audience and they're slam dancing.
Oh, God.
And that was the 90s. It wasn't great. Really, it wasn't great. I'm sorry. Anybody who tells you it was is an idiot. But we can go with that because it's two sides. Two sides. Seem to be giving you dual stories here.
It's okay. Well, maybe let's see how we go. Question three. Tell me about the worst car you've ever driven.
Oh, that's easy. I had... all right. So, I worked in an auto body shop and saved for a year or so and bought my first car cash.
Mm.
It was an old Duquesne Light Company car. It was an 86 Dodge Omni with no power steering and no tape deck, no radio. I don't even think it had air conditioning. Like, it was bare bones. And upon having that car, getting my driver's license, I had driven it for maybe 3 weeks. When I was pulling into my driveway in the middle of rural America and a drunk driver T-boned that car. Just clapped it on the way into the driveway and demolished the car. Which was the first lesson I had in, you spent $1,700 for this car, and guess what? Here's $700 back. Thanks.
Oh.
And in turn, the guy that I worked for at the auto body shop hooked me up with an 85 Dodge Omni that had been somebody else's college car. And you know as well as I do what your first car or your college car kind of is.
And lives through.
Yes.
If you're lucky enough to live through it.
The fuck out of that car. So I got it with maybe 65,000 miles. And for the entirety of the next year of its life, which was all it had left, it did everything it could to blow up, destroy my wallet, and take every dollar that I had to fix. Oh. I learned a lot about fixing cars. I don't use any of that information at this point in time, but I learned a lot about fixing cars. I also went fucking broke. Every other week, I had to fix something on that car. The alternator would go, and it got to the point that by the time it died, I could on and off the alternator on that car in less than 15 minutes.
Wow. Wow. That's impressive. That's like, I guess, a good Yugoslav mechanic could change the timing belt on a Yugo in 30 minutes. I thought that was impressive.
Yeah.
15-minute alternator for an amateur. Pretty not damn bad. Good. Yeah.
I can tell you that laying in an inch of snow in a Walmart parking lot in Butler will teach you quickly, though.
Oh, God. Oh, I need a new car. Anyway. Question four. Have you ever lost sleep over the second law of thermodynamics?
What is the second law of thermodynamics?
The second law of thermodynamics. And this has kept me up at night. So maybe this question is more about me.
This question is about you because I don't even know the second law of thermodynamics.
Second law of thermodynamics is that basically all heat and all energy searches for the void. And that all heat and energy will eventually expend itself, at which time there will be no energy left in the universe, and there's nowhere to go except for the universe, and it will be a completely dead universe.
So you're trying to tell me that this is a metaphor for America now?
I won't say that. I think America now is explosive. Oh, okay. I think there's plenty of energy in America right now.
But it's all flowing to the void no matter what.
It's all flowing to the void, and eventually there'll be no energy left, perhaps. But, yeah, I've lost sleep over that. Because it's really, we're kind of stuck in the universe.
Well, I mean, I'm comfortable with my place in nothingness at this point in time. And, the void and I have accepted each other.
Good. You're on a first-name basis.
We are on a first-name basis.
All right, so question 5. We're almost through this. What is a sacred cow / canonical text that you hate in spite of the fact that everyone reveres it?
Well, I could just go easy with the Bible, but I won't.
We've already had that conversation on this podcast. Yes,
I'm sure you have.
We have.
That's right.
That time you were like, "Do you want a razor blade edit that?" And I was like, "No."
I did lose sleep over that. I was like, "Oh, I wonder how many people are going to hear that and how much shit you're going to get."
Nothing. It was fine. Bridge series didn't get anything. It's all
20 people listened to it. 40 people. It's fine.
And they're true believers. We haven't crossed over.
Yeah, we haven't. We haven't crossed into popularity.
I do have my domain names. .coms, just in case. So no one can take those from me. But.
There are so many. What do you go with? I might need more time on this one. I might need to come back to it.
It's the fifth one. We're fucked.
I know. It's a problem.
We can go with two answers. Top two, top three.
Top two, top three. Yeah, I'm more just like, I'm fishing around at this point in time. I'm like, I don't know where to go. I mean, obviously on the road certainly counts in that regard.
Yes.
As we've spoken about, there's so many flaws to him and to the book itself. Yeah. So why don't we just go with that?
Okay, on the road. We'll go back to on the road.
Yeah, well, it seems like the exact right place to end it because I like to...
Yeah, we close the loop.
Yeah.
So I think that's about it. So again, two great books on Kung Fu Treachery Press. Better Angels of Our Nature, which is a Jason Baldinger solo effort. As well as Everyone's Alone Tonight with James Benger. And Jason's saying is the best book. I really do like it. Both of these are so good.
I've gotten feedback out of Better Angels too.
Better Angels too. Yeah, I think you get better every time. I said, you're the beast mode poet.
Appreciate that.
Right now, and so compelling, so this moment in history, so these stories that must be told and paid attention to. So get those on BN.com, or if you are in Pittsburgh, one of our fine local independent bookstores has them. Book release show is again October 2nd in the year of our Lord 2019.
Mm-hmm.
At White Whale at 7 p.m.
You got it. Hosted by Red Bob. I forgot to throw Red Bob's name in there.
That's right, Red Bob.
I'm getting Red Bob out of retirement to host.
Yes, that's right. I bumped into Red Bob at Minio's. Minio's, and he told me. He's like, I'm hosting that. I was like, I think I'm going to that. And I'm going to that. So you'll see me there. And then you're going on a little tour. Yep. And I guess the best place to tour dates things is
Facebook.
Find you on Facebook. You're also in a couple bands, Pond Hockey, which we'll have a cassette out soon, and we'll talk about that sometime.
Yes.
And Slug Sweater.
Yes.
Because Slug Sweater is
Slug yeah. Sweater is a thing, and yeah, I don't know when we're playing again. So.
No, who knows?
We're working on it.
Yes. So, speaking of not knowing when the next thing's going to happen, our next episode will eventually happen, and it'll be about something.
Something.
Our homepage, where you can find new and our ever-deepening catalog of old episodes, is gonna diepodcast.com. Sorry. We're also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, Podcast Addict, Mixcloud. Did I say Spotify? I think so.
I think you did.
And follow us on Twitter at Gonna Die Podcast. And We're All Gonna Die is on Facebook. And the dog can stop whining because we're going to open that door soon. Yeah. Thank you again, Jason Baldinger. Every time, it's a delightful conversation.
I try and be the appropriate amount of educated and garrulous.
Yes. Later, meats.
All right. 2, 3, 4!